House Labor and Commerce will now come to order. It is 3:20 p.m. on March 2nd. With us, we have Representative Ledoux, Representative Tilton, Representative Hughes, Representative Culver, Representative Josephson, Representative Keto, and myself, Chair Olson. We do have a quorum to conduct business, and we do have a complete, everybody is supposed to be here. Please turn off your phones. We have two items on the agenda today. We're going to finish up with the ICER study, and then hopefully we'll have time to get to House Bill 304. On Monday, we heard from Gunnar Knapp. Unfortunately, we ran out of time. Today, he's going to finish his presentation. The members have, I believe, 15 pages, approximately, to replace the pages, Conrad?
Yes.
That we received a couple days ago. Dr. Knapp, are you with us?
Yeah, hello. Can you hear me, sir?
Oh, yeah, you're coming through fine. And I believe we left off on page 40, didn't we?
Yes. That's correct. First of all, for the record, I'm Gunnar Knapp. I'm director and professor of economics at the Institute of Social and Economic Research at UAA, and my colleague Matt Berman is here with me.
I'd like to thank both of you for joining us.
Last time we finished up, I believe, on slide 40, and we were about to begin with the section on total impacts of deficit reduction on the Alaska economy. I made a few modifications to those slides, and I also wanted to correct one error in a slide that I showed you the other day, which is why I sent down to Conrad 16 new slides that essentially are intended as concluding slides for today's presentation. And I'm curious, are those the what you have on your screen at the moment, and do the members have a copy of those?
Yes.
Okay. So if I might just start with those, so I'm going to go to the second slide, and I just want to briefly revisit. You'll recall an early part of Monday's presentation was on the relative contributions of non-residents and the federal government, and I want to show you two slides that are correcting slides 14 and 15 of Monday's presentation, and we actually discovered a calculation error. A committee member asked a question, and we were thinking about that question, and my colleague Matt Berman said, you know, that number doesn't look right. And he went back and discovered that there's just an error, and so we want to show you the correct number. If you go to slide 3, the issue related to the share of non-residents and the federal government in total payments. And there's just a slight change in the non-resident calculations for the sales tax with fewer exclusions. That went from 7% to 9%. If you go to slide 4, this is the more important change. This is the share that the federal reduced federal government tax obligations would represent. And I believe the question had been, and here the main change is that the corrected numbers are for the federal government share for the income taxes. And the question on Monday had been about why those shares were so small. Previously, I think we had shown them at about 4%. And we were looking at them and thinking, that doesn't make sense. And Matt checked them and discovered, sure enough, there was an error. And these are the corrected numbers, and it makes more logical sense. We apologize sincerely for this error, but these are now our corrected best and rechecked best estimates of what the federal government share of these taxes would be, not in the sense that the federal government pays them, but rather that the the burden on Alaskans of the tax collections would be reduced by this amount of the total because of the reduction in tax payments because these state tax payments could be deducted in calculating the federal tax obligation. I'd be happy to answer any questions about these. Again, I apologize for the that error, but if there's no questions, I can go on.
Please continue.
Okay. So now I'll move on now to slide 5 of this presentation. And I'm now basically simply on some slightly revised slides, replacing the ending slides of the presentation from Monday. So I want to first go to total impacts of deficit reduction on the Alaska economy. Slide 6, please. There's a lot of discussion of the issue of, well, so we have this deficit. How fast do we need to reduce it? And if we reduce it, it will have economic impacts. And, you know, how can we minimize this economic impact on the economy of reducing this deficit? So I want to start with the basic fact of the situation that we're in. And the basic fact is that we've lost billions of dollars of oil revenue, which used to pay for most of the state government. And we're going to have to adjust to the new reality of having much lower oil revenues, and in all likelihood, permanently having much lower oil revenues than we've had in the past. And, you know, we've been, we've begun significant adjustments through significant spending cuts that have already taken place over the past 3 years, but we're going to have to further reduce this deficit for the simple reason that our savings reserves simply are not sufficient to allow us to continue deficits of anywhere near this magnitude. And this reducing the deficit will significantly impact our economy. Actually, regardless of how we do it, the only thing that doesn't reduce the, impact the economy is saving less, but there's a limited extent to which you can do that. So we are going to experience impacts whether we do this through spending cuts, whether we do this through dividend cuts, whether we do this through tax increases. The, you know, exact amount of the cuts, may vary somewhat, as my discussion Monday indicated, but there will be impacts, and they'll be significant. Slide 8. Now, one reason we're going to experience significant impacts is because of actions we've already taken. And here I'm referring to the spending cuts that have been made over the past 3 years, and 70% of these were in the capital budget. And so, as anybody who pays attention to the capital budget is well aware, the capital budget has been drastically cut over the past 3 years. And this is going to have significant future impacts on the state's construction industry and construction spending. The impacts are not felt immediately, because when you budget for a capital project, you typically spend some time planning, and then it takes time to get the thing underway, and it takes the actual spending takes place over several years from when you budget it. And so we have not yet experienced, we've definitely not yet experienced, the budget cuts of the capital budget cuts, say, that were made last year, and a lot of those the previous year. We've had past capital spending still in the pipeline. As that dries up, we're going to have a lot less, and we are going to, our construction industry and the whole economy will feel those impacts. But then we're also going to have to make future adjustments in some combination of spending, taxes, and dividend cuts. Slide 9, please. Now, I'm going to expand on this, but the sort of question is, well, how do we have the least painful adjustment. And what I'm going to suggest is that the least painful or at least it'll be less painful, we'll have a smoother economic adjustment if we make significant progress this year on adjusting this deficit than if we either fully close the deficit this year or if we fail to make significant progress. And I'm going to try to define what I mean by significant progress. Slide 10. But let me first talk about just the fact that adjusting for this deficit will have big impacts. And here, what I have in slide 10, I've taken the numbers that last time on Monday I was showing you our estimates of the short run economic impacts associated with reducing the budget by $100 million, okay? And what this table shows you is using those calculations and just expanding upwards, suppose you look at reduce the deficit on the scale of the actual deficit, and so I've taken hypothetically, suppose you reduce the total deficit by $1 billion, by $2 billion, or by $3 billion, and then I've sort of illustrated hypothetically different combinations of ways you could do it. These are not intended to advocate any of these ways, just to sort of hypothetically make the point that the impact on the economy will, you'll have some combination of these things or other similar things. And what is the scale of the impacts that we're talking about? And so, the first column there is an extreme example where this entire $1 billion or $2 billion adjustment was achieved by cutting workers. Actually, that's not, we're not spending that much total on workers, the $3 billion, you couldn't do it that way. But then I've got, for example, the fourth column over is if you did 25% of each of four things, broad-based spending cuts, progressive income tax, dividend cut, and saving less, and so on. Anyway, so the different columns show for different combinations of how you might do it and different amounts by which you might reduce the deficit, what are the total income impacts, and which are shown in green, job impacts, which are shown in green, and income impacts, which are shown in the orange color. And you can see that if you get into taking $1 billion, $2 billion, $3 billion out of the economy through some combination of these things, you begin to have pretty significant total job impacts, just the scale of that amount. So, for example, if you reduce the budget deficit by $1 billion, if you did it entirely by cutting workers, which you couldn't or wouldn't, that would, in theory, cost the economy 17,000 jobs. Or if you did it through the right-hand column of the four hypothetical combinations, it would be 7,000 jobs. If you did twice the budget reduction, then you get twice the size of job impacts. And these are big numbers. 7,000 jobs, 15, that's a lot of jobs. And but in contrast, in 2014 there were about 367,000 full and part-time jobs in Alaska. So it is, you're beginning to talk about something like the $2 billion becomes 5% of the Alaska total jobs. The point is, they're big numbers. They would definitely be felt in the economy, but they're not catastrophic numbers. They would definitely be felt in the economy if you close this. And so the point is simply really to say, the total economic impact of really closing this deficit will be felt. and, you know, sort of how much it's felt depends on the mix, but it will be felt, and that's really my point.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Josephson, followed.
Mr. Representative Kito was first called.
Oh, okay. Representative Kito, followed by Josephson.
All right, I guess I am going first. Dr. Nampazandi Josephson here in Juneau. I don't sit on the Finance Committee, and so I haven't had the opportunity to look at the governor's fiscal plan in a good 6 weeks, frankly. But when I first looked at it in December and then in January, and in fact, we looked at it together in special session effectively at Centennial Hall in November, what he's done is he's committed all of those resources so that, I mean, his ideal plan, as I understood it, although he'd be happy to see some improvement, was to, at least in the abstract, to fix the deficit this year. But in order to do that, he was committing all the resources. And what I mean by that is the CBR was going to be used for something, and the SBR was going to be reinvigorated. And it seems to me if we only do part of a budget patch and leave, say, $1 billion, very, very abstract theoretical numbers here, and take from the CBR to fill that $1 billion, then his plan, at least, and I know there could be a million plans, but his plan doesn't work because it relies on every available dollar that we have in savings. Do you see where I'm going with that?
I apologize. I don't see entirely where you're going. I agree. My understanding of the governor's full plan, everything, if you throw in, as he put it, all the things he tried to find something for everybody to hate, I'm being a little facetious there, but there's an awful lot of things in that plan which together add up to, I believe, not completely closing the deficit, but mostly sort of doing, you know, the vast bulk of the heavy lifting toward getting the state where the remaining spending would be financed in a sustainable way. That was my take on it. My understanding was that it accomplished those things. If you did all those things, that was what it did. But I'm not quite sure if I understand your question.
Can I try one more step?
Certainly.
Okay. So, Dr. Knapp, let me give you an example. Let's say we have a $3.5 billion deficit. If we had a $2.5 billion fix, we would need to reach into savings for the other billion. And if we did that, the governor's plan begins to fall apart, at least on the margins, because he needed that $1 billion to serve to buttress, for example, the earnings reserve and a sovereign wealth model, or to recreate the SBR, which would spin off some of its own new revenue. In other words, I guess I'm just wondering, does that make sense?
Okay, it begins to. I think that what you're getting at is this conundrum that part of the governor's plan, and actually any of these plans that are being talked about for using permanent fund earnings, they are based on the permanent fund being able, and indeed all our state assets, being able to produce investments for us, produce investment returns for us, and the with every the larger the deficits, as long as we continue to run deficits, those reduce those future earnings beginning next year with the, you know, so, you know, as a hypothetical example, let's say you draw from our savings by another $1 billion this year, and let's say our you could earn 5% on that. Well, then you have $50 million less, you know, permanently less for the future. So I think it's a fair characterization that the larger the deficits we continue to run, the sort of the less we demand of ourselves this year, then the more we're going to have to demand of ourselves in the future, or the less we'll have those investment earnings for use in the future. I haven't said that very well.
That's the essence of it, and so I didn't know if you wanted to elaborate on that
problem, but
I don't have any particular elaboration. In our study, our study, as I'm going to say in my concluding remarks, is pretty narrowly focused on certain aspects of the problem. So our study says, looks at, for example, well, how will it affect the economy if you tax people this year, or if you cut their dividends this year, or if you cut spending this year? And you can say, oh, well, all those things will affect the economy, you know, maybe to different extents. But then the flip side of that is, if you don't do those things, then instead, if you draw from savings, then you have reduced future, future earnings that will sort of permanently mean that you have, you're sort of going to be, when you do adjust things, you're going to have a permanently lower level of savings or higher level of taxes or whatever. So there's this trade-off with the future.
Okay, thank you.
So I guess the focus of this table is on the immediate pain from doing it, but there's a, and I'm actually talking about this in my very next slide, I think, that there's definitely a future pain from not doing it.
We've got a couple more questions for you, Representative Culver, followed by, Guido, followed by Representative Culver.
Thank you, Dr. Knapp. I'm looking at your first column in that table on page 10 and thinking about state employees versus other employees. And if we do 100% spending cut on workers, $1 billion cut says 17,000 workers. I have to assume that there's some multiplying factor in there so that the actual state workers cut might be somewhere around the 10,000 to 12,000 range, which means we're looking at 5,000 to 7,000 for other workers. But, excuse me, where I get into my question is, if you look down at the $2 billion and the $3 billion, I think we get beyond the numbers of state workers that are available, so we can't actually, and I think what you alluded to that, we can't actually cut $2 billion or $3 billion out of the worker side. It's just for illustration. Is that the case?
Yeah, you're right, and both to hear myself say it and to hear you say it, I really should have cut out that 34,000 and that 50,000 number, because it is not a real option. And so I shouldn't have it in there.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Culver.
Yeah, thank you. Dr. Knapp, I'm going to kind of follow up on Representative Keto's question. So what is the indirect multiplier on the job? So that $1 billion cut, broad-based or workers, I was looking more at the broad-based, 13,000 jobs. What are the indirect multiplier for the other spin-off non-government jobs?
Well, the way to do that, I'm going to actually look in, if you looked at slide 36 of the presentation that I gave on Monday, it should have the, this is always risky, it should have the actual numbers, so you can see the direct versus the multiplier there. And so, for example, with the spending, and I rounded here, but with the spending cut, the workers, basically the numbers are the direct. If you cut 100 million, the estimate was 962 direct jobs and 715 multiplier jobs for 1677 total jobs. So here I have 17,000, so the corresponding numbers would be about 9,600 direct and 7,150 multiplier adding up to the seven. So it's sort of maybe, I can't do the math in my head, maybe 60-40, it'd be 60%, the direct government workers, and then the 40% private. On the other hand, the broad-based would be about two-thirds. The numbers for the job impacts of broad-based cuts are 504 and 754, and so, you know, it's more in the private sector and less in the public sector. But the reference to see the proportions of direct and multiplier, you would want to look in at either slide 35 or 36 from Monday.
Okay. Using your thank you, Mr. Chairman. Using your multipliers on the page 36. So I'm looking at column 2, page 10, this year's or today's presentation under broad-based cut. $1 billion reduction, 13,000 jobs. So if I use your 2.5, is what about your multiplier that you've calculated previously, that would be 5,200 state jobs would be cut, equaling a total of 13,000 jobs. Actually, more private sector jobs would be lost.
That's correct, yeah. Okay. I rounded these for... just because it makes it easier to see and because the level of precision doesn't warrant anything more than this, but that if you just sort of extrapolate it up, multiplying the numbers that are underlying these, of the 13,000 corresponding to 1 billion
right.
jobs, 5,000 would be direct impacts on government workers or contractor workers to the extent that the money was being spent directly on a state contract, and then the 7,500 would be the multiplier jobs,
right?
In all the other sectors. So that this broad-based cut would, in the private sector, which in this would be mainly the support industries, the retail and services, and construction and so on. All these industries would be end up being about 7,500 jobs affected by, driven by the reduced spending of you do the broad-based government cut, and that results in the businesses and workers that are directly affected saying, okay, we have less money because the state spent less money, now we as workers and businesses are going to spend less money, and that results in this estimated $7,500 in 7,500 private sector jobs being lost.
No question?
Yeah. Thank you for that. So what number of jobs cut would you consider catastrophic to our economy? I think you said you showed the $1 billion impact reduction to $2 billion, $3 billion, just for illustration on corresponding reduction in employment. You talked about catastrophic. I mean, what would you define as catastrophic? And I guess that goes to other ICER work as far as what number do we have to have government spend reduced to going forward to even be able to maintain the government portion of the economy that we have. In other words, how far is too deep, and where is just right?
Yeah. Well, I wish I could answer you. That's a really important question. But part of the problem we have is as follows: our economy is presently in a weak state. It would be one thing if we had a sort of booming private sector economy, but the government was in financial difficulty and the government had to cut back, but the rest of the economy is going gangbusters. That'd be one thing, but we have a situation where our economy is weakened by, first of all, our oil industries experiencing significant hurt from these very low oil prices, and so we've seen oil industry layoffs, oil industry reduced investment, we're sort of nervously hoping more shoes don't drop, and so that's a source of weakness. Then the mining industry, prices are low. That's a source of weakness. You know, the salmon industry, prices are low. That's a source of weakness. And we have these past capital, state capital cuts that are that together with oil industry reduced investment is sort of leading to a negative forecast for the construction industry. So we have a situation where State Department of Labor is projecting job losses for the current year, and so the economy is in a weak state. And so this puts us in a difficult situation because now if we say, and now government's going to cut back too. You know, either government's going to cut spending, or maybe government cuts spending less, but government's going to come and tax you, you know, or government's going to reduce dividends. So this sort of is stuff on top of it, and it's not desirable. Matter of fact, in an ideal world, you'd say, when the private sector economy is hurting, that's not the time to reduce government spending. That's the ideal way you would think about it, but the other side of this, why that argument doesn't completely hold or doesn't hold for several reasons. But the point is, if you say, what is the sweet spot? How much strain can the economy take before what? Before you sort of reach some kind of tipping point. I don't think that there's a clearly defined. I don't actually think that there is some sort of tipping point. I think that, nor do I think that any of these things, even if you did all of it, gets you to some really catastrophe for the economy. It's just one more significant hit at a time when the economy is weakened, but we don't have the enough knowledge about the details of the economy and just the uncertain state of it because of all the rest of it to be able to say how exactly this would play out. I cannot tell you, sir, what the sort of Goldilocks amount would be. What's just the right amount?
Representative Ledoux, followed by Hughes, and followed by Josephson.
Okay, so if you could just bear with me for a moment, because I flunked graphs in grade school, and I've never gotten too much better on it. So let's take this column 33.
Which page?
Oh, we're on page 10. So that means if you cut by 1 billion, you're going to be reducing 10,000 jobs, and it's going to have a $1.3 billion impact on the economy. So do I have that right, at least?
Not quite. No, it means there will be a $10,000 loss in jobs. The 33 means that you're the way you are reducing the deficit by 1 billion is sort of one third by cutting spending, one third by raising cutting spending by 333 million, you're raising 333 million from an income tax, and you're cutting dividends by 333 million, and the combined impact of all three of those things ends up costing you 10,000 jobs in the short run economic impact.
Right, I understood that. So, and it also ends up reducing your economy by $1.3 billion. Is that what that's saying?
No, actually, yes. Yeah, you have a total loss of income of Alaskans of $1.3 billion.
Billion, so
you see
not million.
At the very bottom, it says that our total combined income, all of us Alaskans, is about $40 billion, and our total wage income was about $27 billion, and so out of that, about $1.3 billion would be gone as a result of doing these combined things.
Okay, that can I follow up on this?
Sure.
Okay, so I think I understand what you're saying there. So, but I see all of these are, you've got a 33, 33, 33, and then ones, you got a 25, 25, 25. What happens if you vary some of these things? So maybe you have a spending cut of 66 and then an income tax of 33. Do you have any charts to show all of those different variables?
Not in this presentation, I don't, but I could easily make them and would be glad to do so if you'd like to see any, but basically you can also do it yourself if you look at the table I was referring to before, from Monday, table 36, because all I did was simply I just sort of took these as hypothetical examples, and the way I did it was simply I took the numbers associated with 100 million. Remember, on Monday I was talking about sort of the impacts of 100 million from any of these different choices, and here I hypothetically showed, now if you went to a billion and you took certain amounts from, you know, from different choices, what does it get? But you could calculate the same, do the same just by, it's just a very simple calculation I did to come up with this table, but so you could recreate it yourself, or I'd be glad to, you know, if you send me an email and I can calculate this for any combination. So I just did this to, basically, if you look at the table on Monday's presentation, slide 36, you can see which ones have relatively bigger or which ones have relatively smaller impacts. And so if you reduce the deficit using relatively more of the ones with smaller impacts, then you'll have a smaller total impact. Or if you do it with relative more of the ones that have bigger impacts, then you'll have a bigger impact.
Well, yeah, because it may be relatively easy for you to create that, but believe me, it's not going to be relatively easy for me to figure it out. What would you say if you wanted to have the least effect on the economy? Which variations would have the least effect on the economy?
The least effect on the economy would come from getting as much of this as possible from saving less. And so if you want to do that on a sustainable way and not draw down your permanent fund earnings reserve, but if you completely stopped inflation proofing and you completely stopped adding to the earnings reserve, that would have the least, and said, okay, we're not going to save, we're going to just use this to help fund government, that would have the least effect on the economy, at least in the short term. In the future, though, you'd have smaller earnings, so you'd sort of get a short-term benefit. Oh, we didn't have to hit the economy by cutting spending or whatever, but in the longer term, you'd have a smaller permanent fund, and so in effect, our kids would have, you know, less government or have to pay higher taxes or something.
Thank you.
It sort of depends on whether you're more interested in, I would say the next thing to do with the least effect on the total economy would be to cut capital spending, because that is the least effect. I mean, it definitely affects the construction industry. The problem is that option is basically all gone. And so the legislature, in effect, took the step through by concentrating the spending cuts on capital spending in previous years. That had less of an effect on the total economy, or partly because it's delayed, but also partly because the way it affects the economy is less than say if you had over those past 3 years cut state jobs, or if you had taxed people or something. But so in effect, the legislature already took that option. There's no more capital budget left to cut. So then I would say you begin to go to painful options, like if you were focused solely on hurting the economy less, then you get less of an impact by having a sales tax or an income tax than by cutting dividends, because if you have a sales tax or an income tax, well, 10% of that is contributed by non-residents, you know, roughly, whereas if it's a dividend, it's us. It's all from us. But all of this is very narrowly focused in terms of sort of minimizing hurt on the present economy, and I guess I would, I'd be the very first person to say that probably, I would sincerely recommend that you and all of us should think about many other things as we think about this than simply what hurts the economy least, but, you know, what are the longer term implications of financing government through, you know, an income tax versus and having an income tax versus having smaller dividends. I mean, that gets to sort of more fundamental issues about the sort of the way, the kind of state we have.
Representative Hughes, followed by Representative Josephson.
Mr. Chair, I have several questions, if that's okay.
Certainly.
Yes, thank you.
That's the way we're going to learn.
That's right. Dr. Knapp, this is not a setup, this first question, but it's just something I need to know, just going into this. And maybe you said it in our first meeting the other day and I missed it, but are you being paid by the administration, were you being paid by the administration to work on this and do this analysis? And also, a tag-along question with that, does ICER receive general funds from in the university budget?
So in reverse order, yes, ICER receives general fund support in the university budget, which covers about 40% of our budget, and the rest is made up with research contracts and grants from a wide variety of sources. Secondly, yes, this particular study was financed half by the OMB and half by DOR.
Okay, thank you. I have another question, Mr. Chair.
Certainly.
I almost called you Mr. Speaker there. my next question is, this is all looking at the short-term economic impact, and I'm just wondering how wise that is to look at things only short-term. I'm thinking of this time that we're going through, like we're crossing a bridge, and we want a strong, sturdy bridge, but what are we going to get to when we get to the other side? Is it going to be nice and stable ground with nice meadows and pastures, or are we going to get over to the other side and we're going to be in mucky muck and our big rocks and just a bad thing on the other side? And so I'm thinking of what's this going to look like, 15, 20 years down the road? What's our economy? What's the private sector? How are my grandkids going to fare? And my understanding is that, for instance, what you're telling us is that if we cut state spending, particularly if we target particular state jobs, that is going to mean more job loss between state workers and private sector workers. But I'm thinking, what about the PERS, TERS, and all that kind of thing that goes on for decades that we will be paying, that will impact the future of my grandchildren and everyone's grandchildren? And just wondering whether how wise this is just to be looking at the short-term aspect. My understanding is that states, for instance, you've showed us that income tax, if we were to implement a income tax, it would be less jobs lost. But my understanding in states that have implemented income tax and increased income taxes, overall, in the long term, it's been worse for their economies. People have packed up and left, and it's been a struggle for the private sector. So I'm not just looking for a strong bridge. I'm looking for what's on the other side. And it sounds like you're really focused on the short term, but can you speak to some of this long-term stuff? Because, of course, I don't want state workers to lose jobs. I don't think anybody around this table does. But we can't just look at the next couple years and how that might affect the bottom line as we try to close the deficit and balance the budget here in this building. We have to think about the bigger picture. At least I feel like I have a responsibility as an elected official to look at the bigger picture. And so can you comment on the long-term economic impacts on the private sector and our overall economy and health as a state in regard to some of these options?
First of all, I absolutely 100% agree with you that the long-term impacts of what we do in these decisions are critically important. And in fact, the entire sort of the last part of my presentation is focused specifically on that. As I'll come to, you'll see, I try to make the point that I've got a number of slides, and including several that talk specifically about longer-term consequences of income taxes and sales taxes, that make the point that all these things, be it spending cuts, income taxes, sales taxes, dividend cuts, can have profound long-term impacts on the kind of economy we have and the kind of society we have, and while people are naturally concerned, and I think it's reasonable for people to ask and be concerned about, well, what are the implications this year if we if we do some of these things, how will it affect the economy this year? But really, what ultimately will matter far more is what are the longer term implications, and these are things that, because this is a pretty small and narrowly focused study, we didn't get into. But what I try to urge you is, please don't look just at the specific things that I've shown here in the study as the only thing relevant. I'd be the first to say that the longer term implications of any of these things for our state will matter a lot more. It's analogous to if I'm sick and I go to the doctor, he says you're sick, and you know, you could do, there's sort of four treatment options, then, you know, I could say, well, which is going to hurt more? Or I could say, well, which is going to get me better? You know, which is going to do best to get me better? And I mean, it's relevant if, you know, one of them really, really hurts and the other works just as well and it doesn't hurt as much. That's fine, but I probably ought to think less about which hurts more and which is going to make me, you know, really make me most healthy. So that's a very long run way of saying I'm getting to that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have another. And just a comment. And I also want to say that in my early question about your connection with the university and the funding, I do have respect for the work that ICER has done over the years. So I just want to put that in there. I meant to say that as part of the question. My understanding is, and maybe I'm wrong, and this is something I think, I don't know if I learned it in high school, so it's been a really long time, but my understanding is, and I might be wrong, so I'm just going to say it, a basic economic principle that I thought was that a dollar in the private sector has a greater multiplier effect than a dollar in the public sector. Would you agree or disagree with that statement? I'm not talking about a jobs or anything, just a pure dollar.
I guess I don't want to get bogged down technically. I would say I could neither agree nor disagree until I sort of had a clearer understanding of what was meant. Basically, what it comes down to is, if you know, there's two people on my street and one of them works for the government and one of them works in private industry, and and one of them loses their job, it's going to have pretty much the same impact on the economy. They're both Alaskans, and it's going to have the same impact on the rest of the economy if they lose their job. Government workers and private sector workers tend to, you know, spend their money in similar ways. Now, I think a lot of the debate has to do with is it more important what would you rather have your economy be doing whatever that government worker was doing, or would you rather have it be doing whatever that private worker was doing? But that's a different question. But in terms of how the money they earn affects the economy, my understanding of this economic question is that it's pretty similar.
Okay, and thank you. One more question, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we got other people queued up.
Okay, and this one, it goes back to Representative Joseph's question about if the way the governor's plan is set up and what happens if you don't, you don't do that $1 billion, and is that going to throw everything off? And then, but it relates to that in that the other day on Monday on slide 8, you said neither extreme is best, doing nothing this year or doing everything this year. And I just want to make sure that's still what you're thinking, that it is better to not do everything in one year and to phase the solution. Is that what you meant the other day?
What I meant and what I'm about to say in the next 8 or so slides is the flip side of this, and that there are very serious negative impacts to not making significant progress on this deficit. And so I think that in terms of it's true our economy is weak, and it's true that if we did everything this year, that could have a large impact. But that should not be, I would strongly caution anybody from misinterpreting that as thinking, oh, we should, this is a reason why we should really save this problem for later. No, I don't think we can save this problem for later. I think there are very strong reasons, which I'll talk about in the next 6 slides, of why it's very important to make significant progress.
Representative Josephson, followed by Representative Colbert.
Thank you. Dr. Knapp. There are many things I could ask you, but you talked the previous day about introducing new money into the economy as a way of being least impactful on existing institutions and existing parts of the economy, sort of as a replacement for the missing $3.5 billion from essentially industry. And I'm wondering, even though the optics of it might look very odd to the public, is there an argument for stimulus, either through returning to some capital budget that has some meaning to the economy, or by issuing bonds for some capital projects that might have meaning in the hundreds of millions of dollars?
I haven't thought through that enough to sort of give you a full answer, but as you'll see in a future slide, if you had a healthy government, and by that if the government's finances are healthy, then there certainly can be made to have an argument for stimulus in a downturn. And so if a significant industry in your state is hurting, or several are, and if the government's got the ability to sort of step in and keep the economy from hurting by spending more, introducing more, then you can certainly make an argument for that. But there's a difference between giving stimulus to an economy on a temporary basis and stimulus to an economy on a permanent basis. Or put this way, we're not in a situation where we can afford to, we can't escape. This is the point of my initial slides. We've lost so much oil money that we can't escape an adjustment. And so it would be nice if we could say, oh gosh, the oil industry's hurting. Let's stimulate the economy by spending more for construction or whatever. But there's also no question that it would definitely help our state's construction industry if we could either spend more for construction or bond more to keep state capital spending going, but there's a we run into the limitations of how are we going to pay for this, and so anything that we do to you know, keep that part of our economy, to help that part of our economy in a time when other spending's dried up, we're going to face the consequences of the limits to our ability to do that, whether we do it out of our limited savings or whether we incur debt, which will increase our future spending obligations.
Thank you.
Representative Colbert.
I'll pass.
I think we're going to hold all the questions until Dr. Knapp finishes up the last 8 pages, because we do have some public testimony coming up on the tobacco bill, if we can get through this.
Okay.
Please continue, Dr. Knapp.
Okay, I'll try to move right along through this. So we've had this discussion, and now on slide 11, that fully closing the deficit this year could have a significant impact on an already weakened economy, because of these impacts that we're already experiencing, so we've got negative things going on, and these would be increased by large spending cuts, new taxes, or dividend cuts. But, and there's a big but, the government can't, we can't permanently support an economy by running deficits. We can't avoid significant further economic impacts of adjusting to lower oil revenues. And we can only delay them by drawing down our savings, and we can't delay them very long because we don't have enough savings. And then, and this is the most important point I want to make, delay has significant negative economic consequences. Slide 13, please. And in particular, I want to talk about the negative economic consequences of continuing very large deficits without a clear plan for how to fix them soon. And there are some of these consequences that are absolutely certain. And I've listed these on this page. If we continue to run large deficits, we will further drain our reserve funds, we'll have lower future investment earnings, and future Alaskans will pay for a deficit that we run this year in lower future earnings. And in addition, if we say, we want to put this off because we don't want to hurt the economy, well, then you're compressing into an even shorter period of time the inevitable adjustments that will have to be made. We'll have to, instead of starting now, the less we start them now, the shorter the remaining period of time with which they'll have to be done. The less time to plan them. The worst situation to get into is one where we've completely run out of money and we have to in 1 year with no time to think how to do it, do all this stuff. And then we can be absolutely certain that if we don't make significant progress this year, we will see further downgrading of Alaska's credit rating. And there were, you know, stories about it in the paper yesterday and today. The other two bond rating agencies came out and issued stern warnings and said, if the legislature doesn't show that they've, you know, got a plan for how to fix this, we will downgrade your credit rating. That's how we look to people outside who just are not emotionally invested in us and just sort of look at our revenues, and they're saying no progress does not look like a reliable bill payer. If you go to slide 14, there are additional negative consequences beyond those that I already talked about of continuing very large deficits without a clear plan for how to fix them soon. And these are these include, we have further rising business and household uncertainty about what lies ahead. Until we make the tough choices we have, we don't know what the level of state services will be. We don't know what the level of taxes will be. We don't know what the level of dividends will be. We don't know what kind of state we're looking at. And in addition, and this is, we face the risk of further damaging confidence in whether we actually can make these choices and whether we can achieve a sustainable, stable, and predictable state spending and revenues. And this, I would argue, raises doubts about the extent to which it impairs confidence about whether we're a state where businesses want to invest or whether we're a state where Alaskans want to work, live, and call home. And this all plays into the impact of reduced business and household investment, and also has effects on public and private employee morale, turnover, and recruitment and cost. These are consequences of not demonstrating that we have a plan for how we're going to get out of this, and sort of saying, oh, let's postpone this because we want to avoid the economic impact. Now, can we measure these consequences precisely? Can we measure the economic impacts of uncertainty, of confidence, and can we translate that into what the investment effects will be? No, we can't. But are these impacts real and important? Yes, they are. Slide 15. And this is why I argue, and argued at the beginning, we'll have a smoother economic adjustment to lower oil revenues if we make significant progress this year. And by significant progress, I mean a major real reduction in the deficit and consensus on a plan of what else that doesn't get done this year will need to do, what it will be, and when we'll do it. And we have to significant progress means demonstrating we have the political ability to get there. And the measure of whether you've made significant progress is whether Alaskans, businesses, and households perceive, whether people think, yeah, the legislature really made progress on this. I have confidence that we've made progress and we're going to get there. So significant progress is not considered continued major uncertainty about, as we have now, about how we're going to stabilize our finances and doubt about whether we can. So that's what I mean by the smoother economic adjustment is not if we try to do everything at once, but also not doing nothing, and really the smoothest is significant progress. Now I'm going on to slide 16, other impacts of fiscal options. And this is following up on the point I made a little earlier. Slide 17, all the fiscal options that we've talked about have many, many other potential impacts beyond the narrow sort of short-term focus that we've studied. They have indirect impacts that are longer-term, that are harder to estimate, but which are potentially much more important to Alaska's future. Slide 18. So, for example, and I'm going to talk about spending cuts, I'm going to talk about taxes, and I'm going to talk about dividend cuts. If you think about spending cuts, it's not just by any means just if you cut workers, well, you got less jobs, and then that has a multiplier effect on the economy. And these are some potential effects of different kinds of spending cuts. Certain kinds of cuts could result in increases in local taxes if the responsibilities get shifted to local governments. Certain kinds of spending cuts could result in increases in user fees, for example, higher university tuition or marine highway fares or park fees. Certain kinds of spending cuts could result in losses of matching federal revenues, which would multiply the impacts of the cuts on the economy. If you reduce the capital budget, you affect the quality and scale of the infrastructure of the state and the potential for future resource development. Certain kinds of spending cuts may impact the government and university workforce in terms of the morale and quality of the workers and turnover. if you go to slide 19, then there's all kinds of other potential impacts related to, you know, spending cuts. And they're just hypothetical examples. And my point is not to argue against any of these spending cuts. I realize that there's a necessity for spending cuts. But my point is that if you care about the economic effects on the state, you need to think about these things as we and try to balance them as you think about any particular kind of cut. So if you think, well, we have to cut funding for the Marine Highway, well, it's not just how many jobs of Marine Highway workers are we going to cut, it's also how will that affect tourist travel and possibly the tourism economy. If you cut the fish and game budget, it's not just, well, you know, there's that many fewer fish and game workers, it's going to affect sort of what level of confidence the managers have and how conservative they are, and that affects how much fishermen catch and so on. And certain of these things, I've listed them. You can read the others. The point is that there's a lot more that is important than what our study looked at, and all of these other things matter and may matter much more than the short-term things we looked at. Slide 20. Income taxes. There's awful lot of talk about how income taxes affect. If you earn more money, we're going to tax you more. Or if your business earns more money, we're going to tax you. That affects incentives. It can affect investment. Arguments have been made that it affects growth rates of states. Income taxes would also affect the wage rates that we need to attract workers in certain industries where we've traditionally relied on a non-resident workforce because most Alaskans don't want to do the jobs, for example, fish processing labor. And then that would affect fish prices paid to fishermen. And then 21, sales taxes. That can affect visitor spending, for example. Well, this is more expensive because of the sales taxes or administrative costs. So my point is not to argue that any of these things that I've listed here trump anything else. I'm certainly not. We do face tough choices. My point is that I'm agreeing with the representative earlier who argued that we're going to think about longer-term impacts, and I'm simply saying, yeah, these matter a lot. So I don't want to say in any way that, our studies are irrelevant, but I'd say don't stop with the things we studied. All these things really are relevant to the discussion if we care about the economy. And then on slide 23, I've just, listed some more. There's a lot of things, a lot of big questions that our study just didn't get into that are all potential long-term impacts of how we adjust to the deficit. And so there's many more questions. And my concluding slide is slide 24, that these choices that you folks are having to struggle with, these difficult choices, are going to significantly affect our future economy and society, whatever way we go. And so we should think not only about their short-term economic impacts, but also their longer-term economic and social impacts that really will drive what kind of state we have for ourselves and our kids and grandkids. And with that, I'm done.
Okay, we've got four or five of us signed up, starting with me, Dr. Knapp. We had heard that this is either the third or fourth draft of the study. Is that correct?
Yes, it's true. This is the third or fourth version, which has appeared in some form to various people in response to people sort of begging us, "Can't you please give us what you have at the moment?" And then and so on. So we've been trying as hard as we can to finish it up, and this is the most complete version. And we're still working to finish up the final full report. Yes.
So I guess my second question is, was there anything dropped out?
No, there's nothing dropped out. We've simply added to it. We have modified
a few sections as we've discovered errors or as we've sort of done more detailed analysis. But we haven't dropped anything out. No.
The only reason I'm asking is we heard in committee on at least one or two occasions that the impact study was going to go into more detail on various of the other tax bills. But apparently,
yeah, and I apologize. That was a misunderstanding, and I sincerely apologize to the extent that I contributed to that by sort of misconveying what we were going to do. All along in our mind, this is what we were able to do, and we did. This is what we've been planning to do, but I think that the impression mistakenly got conveyed that we were going to look at other things, which were sort of more complicated and beyond the scope. And so I don't doubt at all the need for many more, much more economic study about some of the other important issues facing the state, but this is all we ever intended to take on.
Well, thank you for clearing that up, and we'll start off with Ledoux, followed by Josephson and Hughes.
So,
you know, excuse me, I can't hear you. Something went wrong on the mic. I can barely hear what you just said.
Can you hear me now?
I can. If I strain, I can hear you, but something, the volume got turned down on the mics or something.
How about on this one?
It's the same. I'll put my ear up real close and listen as hard as I can. I can understand you. Suddenly.
We're back on the record, and what I was saying is we have Representative Ledoux, Josephson, and Hughes queued up. So, Representative Ledoux.
So, this is where I'm confused. If we don't do everything now, and creditors, businesses, etc., they want us to make significant progress, which means consensus on a plan, what else we need to do, and when we will do it. Well, since one legislature can't bind another legislature, why would the bond markets, for example, so let's say at the end of the session we manage to actually do something, and let's say maybe it's a 19-21 vote. Why would the bond markets think that in the next legislature, when we need to do something else that might be part of the plan that we came up with this year, think that the next legislature is going to make those same sorts of decisions because there might be new people? I mean, how would that appease or make feel more comfortable people who are looking for our ability to make needed adjustments in the future?
Well, you know, a 21-19 vote is going to convey a very different message than a 39-1 vote or a 60-0 vote. The issue I'm talking about, the problems, the negative economic consequences, whether it be from the bond rating agencies or from Alaskans themselves or from businesses, relate to uncertainty and confidence in the ability to solve it. And so ultimately the question is, are you able to reduce that uncertainty and create confidence that this can be solved? One way to do it is to, you know, fully implement a plan that, you know, and so on. But another way to do it is to do enough that, you know, and the real test is do people think, well, yeah, we see how Alaska will get out of this. We see the way forward. I think that the uncertainty will be greater if the session ends and people go home and they don't say, we don't see where this is going. And I would say if, you know, some if you have some vote that is liable to be totally undone 2 months from then we have a problem of continued uncertainty.
So in other words, you're saying that we not only need to do something, but we all need to do it together, and if it's a slim margin, that's not going to accomplish the purposes?
I'm saying, all I'm really saying is that the negative economic consequences of delay are tied to the extent that they create business uncertainty and business and household and investor uncertainty about what will be done and whether something can be done. And so, what are the elements of what contributes to that? Well, one, if you don't, and I'm not implying that anything should happen, but here are bad things. So if the budget stays the same size, that's bad. If the deficit stays the same size, and the deficit doesn't get reduced, people say, "Geez, that doesn't make me confident." If large numbers of the legislature are sort of firmly entrenched in opposing positions and say, "I will never go along with, this person's plan," and there's no apparent resolution, no apparent ability to work through that, that's uncertainty. So I'm not saying this is easy. It's got to be incredibly hard. This is contrasting the two extremes. Yes, there's an impact of there's an impact on the economy if you. Let's say you say, "Oh, we all got together, we sang Kumbaya, and we completely solved the deficit." Somebody might come along and say, "Well, man, that's going to have a big impact on the economy, so maybe you want to hold off." Well, it's okay to hold off, but it's not okay to hold off and leave investors, households, and businesses sort of uncertain about how this is going to play out. It's not okay in the sense that it will have negative economic consequences if that happens. So this is a tough situation because I know that it's not easy. In fact, it's not easy to get there. So but I'm saying that it will be the smoothest economic, it matters to try to reduce this uncertainty, and the way you do it is you find real solutions, and or you make progress to showing that you can reach agreement on what those are. I realize how excruciatingly hard that is, so I should stop talking. Sorry.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. I'll do these tasks, Mr. Chairman. On slide 18, Dr. Knapp, you talk about loss of matching federal revenues, and this is something I've really taken an interest in. And I was trying to think of something really frivolous, and the best I came up with was the colonizing of Mars. Okay, and I'll tell you where I'm going with this. It strikes me that every time the federal government says, "We'll give you $4 or $5 if you put in a dollar," the huge presumption, and I mean just about every time, should be, "We dive in." And I thought, what about something like colonizing Mars? And I'm not convinced that we still shouldn't do it. I mean, and I wanted to get your input on that. This has come up in the context of the university budget, and I've seen it in a number of other places. Are we right that the $4 from Washington, D.C. that gets spent in Alaska has the same impact, generally speaking, as the dollar we supply?
Well, whether the federal government pays for a road project or a building or we do, it has the same impact on the construction industry. Whether the state government pays for a research project at the university or the federal government does, it has the same impact on the you know, on research activity at the university, and that's economic, its economic impact. Whether the federal government pays for health care or we do, it has the same impact on the healthcare economy. If you can, you know, and one of the major ways that the Alaska economy works is because the federal government pours a lot of money into the state. That's sort of roughly one third of the state's economy in total, all the different kinds of federal spending. So if my only point was that if you say, it's one thing if you say, well, we have to take $100 million of spending cuts because you know times are tough. And you can say, well, that'll have a certain effect on the economy, but it'll have, if the federal government was going to match that with $400 million, why the impact on the economy would be four times as great if you cut something that brings in matching funding, you know.
All right, and thank you. And then my last question was on page 19. You said higher potential future costs. One example was social service costs if people leave villages. And I just was struck by that. I mean, I would think that whatever we're doing for people or they're doing for themselves in villages should be this sort of the same wherever they are. And can you explain that?
Oh, my only implication, it's one of many things I've heard. If people, one of the scenarios that's been talked about is, we might reduce education costs by closing some schools, and then there's an issue of would that lead to people leaving villages, and then if they leave the villages, they're unable to do, you can spin out a scenario where they're therefore unable to do subsistence, or they've got they don't have their own local safety network of their friends and family, and that can potentially result in higher social service costs in some urban area or regional center. And my point is, I don't know, I certainly don't know how real that, maybe that impact wouldn't occur. Maybe that's not a concern, or maybe it's a big concern. But I'm saying that if we really want to understand the economic impacts, that's something we ought to think about and try to learn about, it because it could be a significant impact. I haven't studied it. I haven't really thought about it but I wrote it down here because I'm aware it's all these things I've listed simply because I've heard some people suggest that these might be impacts. The extent to which they actually are, I don't know. But these I think are relevant kinds of things and there are probably many, many others that we might want to, that ideally if we had time, and we certainly don't have a lot of time, and we would look at these kinds of questions and others and say, well, which are potentially most important, and then we would try to think about them more, or you might seek testimony because they become part of, if you're concerned about economic impacts, these things may also matter.
Thank you.
Representative Hughes.
Thank you, and I'll try to keep it short, Mr. Chair, because I know you have people waiting online. I just want to ask Dr. Knapp, you to consider something. I want to say that I appreciate the presentation. Learning this information is really important to me. I hold certain principles and convictions very near and dear to my heart and stick with them, but also I'm open to new information and like to consider myself a consensus builder and being pragmatic with that. And so the information you present is important for me, and that there's something that's a little bit troubling that I'm going to point out to you. I'm going to be honest with you. It seemed like there was a bit of bias, and maybe it was just a matter of you were in a hurry making these slides. But when we started on slide 18, 19, and we're looking at examples of impacts of spending cuts, I noticed there were two full pages. But then when I looked at the next, where we have examples of income taxes and sales tax, just a very short list, and I would ask that you consider going back to those two pages that hardly have any, because I think that there are a lot more impacts there that than what you put. You know, taxes tend to cause job losses, for instance, in the long term. So there are a lot of impacts that that aren't listed, and I feel like there, it. If I were just looking at this, I would say, well, Dr. Knapp wants me to think that spending cuts is the worst idea of these. And I don't, you've repeatedly said that you're trying to stay objective here, so I would ask you to reconsider those slides and maybe make that approach a little more fair as you present it the next time, since you seem to be revising this presentation here through the time here in the session. Thank you.
I that's a very fair statement. Just one thing, part of the problem with one reason why there's just so many more things on spending cuts is because there's so many, you know, income tax is an income tax, and there's a major, you're very correct, there's a major debate and set of concerns and issues related to how an income tax may affect an economy, but it's sort of, it's you know, can be boiled down to one or two questions. But if you go to spending cuts, well, you know, we got a million different, well, not a million, but we got an awful lot of different kinds of spending that can play out. So it's, that's why it's easier to list questions. But I it was certainly not my intention to indicate that these concerns and long run impacts might not be any less profound or important to think about. And so I will try to give both a better real and you know, perceived perception of that of the point you just made.
Thank you. Any further questions for Dr. Knapp? Thanks again for joining us twice. We're going to continue on with public testimony on House Bill 304. We have 11 or 12 people signed up. One is a repeat. I don't think we don't have time to do people that have already testified. It looks like there might be a spouse or two from people that have previously testified. If you are, I'd appreciate if you really keep it short. We're going to try to keep it under 2 minutes of testimony so we can close it out. This is House Bill 304 is a bill you either love or you hate. I think if you want to sum it up by that, it will help us keep the numbers straight. But with that, I think we'll start out with Stephanie Chilton, Soldotna LIO. Are you with us, Stephanie?
Hello, my name is Stephanie Chilton, and I own High Voltage Vase in Soldotna. Please don't support House Bill 304. Don't support this bill, because if this bill goes through, it will cripple my business. The local economy is already in a crisis with oil prices so low. I have seen the effects of that personally, as my husband was in the oil field. He is not anymore. My home's entire livelihood is riding on my business being successful. I have 3 kids at home counting on me. My business is what puts food on the table and clothes on their backs. My business has already been affected by the economy. I have already closed one shop and had to let go of 4 employees, reducing another to part-time. If this bill passes, you will see a family of 5 put on welfare. The only thing this bill will do is lose the state money. The thousands of dollars you're currently getting in taxes already will turn into zero as people will start shopping online. They will stop supporting their local businesses because online is cheaper. Please don't let my business be affected by this, too.
Thank you, Stephanie. And if you have written testimony, if you could ask Allison for our email address, we'll make it part of the permanent record and it'll be part of the packet. Thanks again. Tristan Taslian?
Taliesin. My name's Tristan Taliesin. I am a local homeowner and a consumer. Been vaping for about 7 months. After smoking for 28 years, vaping has been the only thing that has consistently and successfully helped me stay away from smoking tobacco products. If this bill passes, I will most certainly take my business online, because the cost of vaping is right now just less than smoking cigarettes, but only in the sense that, you know, I can afford to buy local now. If the price goes up on local stuff, then I won't shop local, and I will take my business online and out of state. I vote here. I live here. I was trained as a firefighter here. And I dispatched from here for the United States Army when I was a veteran. And now I have my kids and my family here, and I'm very grateful to have e-cigarettes and vaping in my life as a result of the consumer-driven market that it really is. And let it be no mistake, it is a consumer-driven market. It's really sprung up nationwide as a consumer-driven market as an alternative to smoking tobacco products. And if laws pop up that make it more complicated than, you know, the online business for it overseas and out of the United States as well as other places in the United States thrives just fine. And that's where most of that business will go. And that's all my money that's spent locally that will be spent somewhere else. You know, so that's my two cents. Thank you.
And thanks, Ken. And same request. If you have some written testimony, Allison can help you get it down to it and be part of the permanent record as well. Seth Parker.
I'm Seth Bafer. Vaping saved my life. I started vaping in January of 2015 as a way to quit smoking. As of March of 2015, I have not had one cigarette. I no longer have any urges. And I truly believe vaping has saved my life. Passing House Bill 304 will only hurt local businesses. HB 304 will destroy the vapor industry in Alaska. Adding the tax on all vapor products will force me as a consumer to take my money out of state. I enjoy going to local vape shops and keeping money local and supporting local and small businesses. But adding the tax will no longer make it financially smart for me to buy local. And I will have to spend money online and order out of state. Thank you.
Thank you again, and same request. If you could sum it up and put it to us in writing, it'll carry a weight when it goes into the packet. Robert Flood, next.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Flood is right here.
No, he left.
He had to go, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Jordan Edwards.
My name is Jordan Edwards. I've lived in Alaska for 30 years. I've lived in Massey for 25. I smoked for roughly 10 years and managed to quit using vapor products. I've been vaping for about 5 years. House Bill 304 will drastically impact small business in Alaska. I urge you to consider the impact it will have on these small shops, the local consumers, the public, including myself, as well as the heavy impact it will have on the local and state government. I want to emphasize that vaping is not smoking. This verbiage is stated in New York's recent case, the People versus Smith. If 100% wholesale tax is put into effect, it will take away from the state. How you ask? Shops will not be able to compete. 155% in Mattsu alone. All shops will close. All current vapors will be forced to return to smoking or look to purchasing online. It will also stop the first line of defense in underage vaping. Shops currently ID customers for the sale of vapor products. If shops aren't in place to stop underage sales, the first place kids will turn is to online purchases. Anyone can purchase a prepaid Visa at Walmart, go on the internet, and purchase vapor products. A tax will exacerbate this process. The state will see these shops close. Consumers such as myself will all, of course, turn to internet purchases. We will see lost jobs, lost taxes, lost in-state commerce and revenue. Storefronts will sit empty. No utilities will be collected. The state will suffer far greater than choosing a realistic tax. In conclusion today, I just want to leave you with a shocking statistic that will be a reality if this something doesn't change. Over the next decade, 1 billion people will die to tobacco-related illness. 1 billion people, that is roughly one-seventh of the world's population. I ask you to look around this room and sentence 1 in 7 people to death. This will be your judgment if you choose to demonize this life-saving product.
And thank you again, and if you haven't already done so, you could provide us with written testimony as well.
All right, thank you.
Elizabeth Ripley.
Representative Olson, members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Ripley, and I serve as Executive Director of the Mattsu Health Foundation. Our Board of Directors strongly supports HB 304 for two main reasons. One, because increased tobacco taxes reduce youth and adult smoking rates, and two, because this tax includes e-cigarette products, which are currently outside of Alaska's laws and tax structures because they didn't exist when these laws were put in place. Higher taxes prevent youth tobacco use and also reduce health care costs. Research shows that local and state level policies that increase the unit price of tobacco products contribute to the non-use of tobacco among youth. a $1 a pack tobacco tax by the Matsu Borough and a simultaneous $1 a pack tax at the state level in 2005 were extraordinarily effective. Between 2005 and 2013, smoking decreased 58% for Matsu middle schoolers, 8% for traditional high schoolers, 22% for alternative high schoolers, and 35% for adults. That's a huge health and economic win for those individuals, for their families, and for our community and state. That's why the Matsu Health Foundation supports increasing Alaska's tobacco tax. We also like this bill because it includes e-cigarette products. Adolescents perceive them as safer than traditional cigarettes. But let's address the myth that these products are safer or that they are a cessation tool. They are the opposite. They are a grooming tool, grooming kids to accept, like, and become dependent on tobacco and nicotine. E-cig liquids are flavored like bubblegum, gummy bears, and Skittles to increase their appeal to youth. And when they're hooked, kids try traditional tobacco products. A 2015 NIH report showed that ninth graders who used e-cigs were over three times more likely to start using combustible tobacco products than those who didn't use e-cigs. Remember, most tobacco use begins before age 18, when it's illegal. So it behooves the companies that make, sell, and distribute e-cigarettes to hook the next generation of smokers while they're young. Because once addicted, these kids will use tobacco products long into adulthood. Lastly, if they are so safe, as reputable as these companies would lead you to believe, would you approve of your child or grandchild smoking an e-cigarette? Would you? If the answer is no, I beg of you to pass this tax, which includes e-cigarette products, to help protect all of Alaska's children. The Matsu Health Foundation has done a great deal of research on how to impact population health. Reducing smoking is one of the most impactful things that we can do to radically improve the health of Alaska's population.
Mr. Chair.
We encourage you to pass this proposed tobacco tax increase. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. We take a question. Representative Josephson?
Yes. Ms. Ripley, could you send the committee the report you mentioned that said there was a three times greater likelihood of using combustible, I guess, tobacco if you use e-cigs?
Yes, I'd be glad to.
Let's see. We're going off line now. Allison Halpin, are you with us?
Yes, sir. Good afternoon. My name is Allison Halpin, and I am testifying to oppose House Bill 304. I am testifying as a liquid manufacturer, a vape shop manager, and as a consumer. With this proposed tax, I will be affected heavily. First, I will be taxed for manufacturing liquid for sale in this state. Then I will be taxed at the retail location I run, as my wages are based off the profitability of said location. And finally, I will have to pay a higher retail price for the liquid I purchase because of this tax. This tax will decimate an industry in this state that is helping people get off of cigarettes. I myself quit smoking 3 years ago using a personalized vaporizer, and I have been able to help countless others also quit smoking. With this tax, the state will be making this life-saving product unreasonable to purchase locally. This tax will push customers to online retailers. You will see our opponents time and time again throw kids in front of you to discuss vaping in junior high and high schools. Remember, vape shops are the first line of defense against underage vaping. I was able to speak to the town hall at the town hall meeting on Saturday, and I spoke about how the demographics of people who smoke are individuals who suffer depression and other mental illnesses, are low income, and in high stress environments. This bill will push those individuals to cigarettes and make this 95% safer alternative out of their budget and therefore no longer an option. This will affect the healthcare system negatively. I urge you to pull this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Eric Margeson.
Yeah, hi, my name is Eric Margeson. I'm from Fairbanks, Alaska. This tax, I oppose this tax because doing a wholesale tax on vapor products will, without a doubt, close some shops in Alaska. And force people who currently shop locally to go online. They won't receive the help they need when it comes to battery safety, because a lot of those services aren't offered online unless you're looking at YouTube videos. You know, when they need help, like for say having a rough day and they're trying to quit. You know, quitting's hard, and sometimes you need support. You need people that almost become your family. And a vape shop really provides that. But most importantly, they check IDs. Every vape shop I've ever went to in Alaska has checked my ID. They shun people who are under the age of 19 away from vaping. I mean, there's no other better way to say it. You know, by imposing this tax, you're going to effectively put people out of work and close shops down. And people like me who tried every traditional means, FDA cessation, you know, smoking cessation product, to quit, and where that failed, you know, we're not going to have the opportunity to quit. You know, thank you for your time.
Thank you again. We have four people online that are all from the vaping industry. We've had a lot of testimony on it. I'm going to ask each one of you if you could really keep it short, because we need to vacate the room in just a couple minutes. So I think I'll start out with Carol or Angela. Carol, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Thank you for joining us today.
I'm going to try to keep it short. Good afternoon, Chairman Olson and members of the House and Labor and Commerce Committee. My name is Angela Carroll, and I live in Wasilla. I'm speaking on behalf of the members of the Smoke-Free Alternative Trade Association. We have been studying the tax reporting requirements that would be applied to small vape shops in Alaska under HB 304. If this legislation passes as written, this bill would tax vape products at 100% of wholesale price and treat our alternative products just like cigarettes. From what we've been told by the Department of Revenue, these small operations will be required to carry tobacco license issued by the state of Alaska as if we were selling tobacco products, which we are not. We offer our customers an alternative to smoking tobacco. We believe that lumping vape products into tobacco tax scheme is the wrong approach for our small business operation. There are several forms that the vape shops will be required to file. There's an importation report, a manufacturer's certificate of compliance, a monthly tax report, etc. And all of you should have a copy of these forms in your committee packet. I'd ask for you to take a look at the multitude of forms that are required by the state of Alaska, the Department of Revenue. Form 510 is what our e-liquid manufacturers will have to file.
Angela, could you wrap it up? We're about ready to lose the room.
Would you like me to continue, or would you like me to submit this as a written testimony?
Oh, well, we'd love it as written testimony. Becomes part of the permanent packet.
Perfect, because this is very, very important. These forms will absolutely make the vape industry in noncompliance the minute this bill passes into law.
Excellent.
We will not be able to comply.
Thank you again for joining us today. James Griggs.
Yes, I'm here. Make this as quick as possible. I'll read through real quick. Good afternoon, committee. My name is James Briggs. I reside in Anchorage, Alaska. I own and operate an e-liquid company called Peshpoggin Sauce. I'm calling today because I do not support HB 304. The reason I do not support this bill is because the proposed 100% wholesale tax will not only hurt me as a consumer, it will drive me out of business. This tax will do nothing but shut down local businesses and drive consumers to online sales. I'd like to give you a little insight into e-liquid. E-liquid contains PG, VG, artificial and natural flavorings, and sometimes nicotine. The VG cost me around $30 a gallon. The flavorings vary in price from $100 a gallon to $200. Just depending on the complexity of the flavor. The nicotine costs $300 a gallon. With this proposed tax, I'll make those prices double for my business. Nicotine will now cost $600. This will cause me to have to raise my prices from $8 a bottle wholesale to $16 a bottle wholesale, therefore putting my product on the shelf for up to $32 a bottle. That price is absurd, and the only thing that price will do is cause local consumers to go online and purchase from online vendors, which in reality is only going to shut down local businesses, and when it turns around, that's going to hurt state taxes. This bill could cause some of those people to go back to cigarettes. Cigarettes contain 4,000 chemicals, and when combusted, it multiplies that amount. Also, around 43 known chemicals in cigarettes cause cancer. So I urge you to pull this proposed tax as unjustifiable.
Thank you again for joining us. We have two people from California in the industry. We're losing the room right now, so if Ed Volz and Jay Oku could provide a written testimony to the committee, we'll include it in the packet. And with that, we will close out public testimony. And I'd like to acknowledge that we have Dr. Jay Butler in the room for any questions, and I've been remiss for not introducing him again. But if any of the committee has any questions for him, you know where to find him. But during the February 19th presentation of the bill, the committee had a few questions from the Department of Revenue. To date, my office has not received feedback from the department. At this time, we will set the bill aside pending receipt of the answers to the previously submitted questions. And with that, we adjourn at 5 minutes after 5.